broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Very, very good morning, guys. Good morning in the studio and good morning to our listeners.
Good morning, Steph.
Hey, the studio. Where is the studio these days?
Well, it's quite funny. You all look very serious in these little squares on my computer here. Mm. Why so glum? Is it the cold weather?
Oh, I like this weather. I think this weather's fantastic, and I'm looking forward to hopefully a bumper snow season.
Yeah, if they let us out.
What to look at.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think we're going to get one.
Do you also think Collingwood's going to win?
That's a late hour, Mazaire. They're 1-0 at the moment. 100% win rate so far this year.
And a good percentage.
And what about these social distancing measures? If five people allowed to your home now, is everyone having a house party?
I've been invited to one tomorrow.
Yeah, tonight. It's happening.
Yeah, it's happening pretty quickly, isn't it? I've heard the invites go out, what are you up to next weekend? Oh, let's catch up for dinner. What are you up to the weekend after? Oh, let's catch up for dinner.
Quite funny, though. It's still a bit undercover.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it can be a bit insulting for the friends that aren't invited. If you're going to have, you've only got maybe three or four people you can have over to your house. Someone's going to get the arse.
Yeah.
And I think I did mention to you just before, I was certainly reading an article just before we got on the phone that Corporate Australia is starting to think about scaling back offices now, given that more people can and probably will continue to work from home. You heard anything on that?
Only anecdotally. Certainly the feedback is that a lot of employers who thought they couldn't adapt to the flexible workforce, they've been forced to in this environment, haven't they?
Mm. Yeah.
And so it's forced a lot of businesses to innovate and adopt new technologies to allow them to still have a productive workforce.
That's true. I mean, we were just sort of mentioning too that my business was sort of thinking about moving to green and gold teams, so one in one week and one in the other. Joel suggested that you could be black and white in line with Collingwood. How do you feel about that?
I think we've already locked it in, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, locked it in as in the true Collingwood style, locked it in as in you get to the last step and then you just don't quite.
Just falter.
Easy, Tiger.
I totally agree with you, Louis.
Come on now.
I guess we've got to have something to look forward to, right?
Yeah, we do.
Still an open wound there, mate.
Not that long ago.
On that workspace thing, it's a bit of history repeating because a lot of businesses tried the flexible workspaces and allowing working from home. And then you started to have this trend of businesses going back the other way and saying, no, we're going to can the working from home idea because it doesn't really work. It doesn't have our people accountable enough. It's too difficult to schedule the things that need to be scheduled. So this is sort of going to be round two.
People moving. I think it's funny because so many organisations have moved to hot desking and now it's such a problem with germs spreading. I don't know how they're going to do that. We'd have to roll it back or fumigate each desk before people move to another desk every day. So it is repeating itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it is repeating itself. And the thing with hot desking is that there's often not enough seats per person, and often those seats are closer together than the required 2 meters distance in the workspace. So if social distancing continues long term, and the other thing employers might find is that social distancing could lead to reduced rates of transmission of the common cold in the office and so lead to a general reduction of absenteeism.
Mm-hmm.
So all these different factors, who knows how they're going to play out. Some employers are trying to go to less floor space, but they'll probably need Brett was saying they'll probably need less floor space. More floor space for less people.
Yeah. I think there'll be a lot of people continuing to work from home. I think I've spoken to quite a lot of people that are actually enjoying the isolation part because they don't have to deal with annoying people. So it's going to be very interesting. So it just depends on personality.
One of the things I think when people are working from home now, they don't have a lot of other things they can do, so they will work. But if the weather's good and they're allowed to get outdoors and go shopping, how do you know they're going to stick to doing their work?
Or the gym.
Yeah. Once there's other options, they may not be as productive as they are now.
Yeah. I think many people, though, have spoken at the moment. I think I mentioned to you again before we got onto this call today that, it's – I've actually lost my train of thought. Isn't that funny?
Well, have any of you noticed the sanitary teams walking around the streets?
I have.
Yeah, definitely.
I've seen them in the city. I've seen them out in our suburb as well. They seem to be out there all the time.
Not in my suburb, mate. We must be clean already.
Could be the other way.
Cleaning door handles and office build, like the doors on the office buildings.
Yeah. Letterboxes, street lamps, all sorts of things. Anywhere people can touch by the looks of things.
Yeah, and there's quite a lot of them out as well. So
they seem to be in groups of about 5 to 10 from what I've seen.
They probably need to be in the city at the moment with some of the characters I've seen.
Yeah, they might focus on a hotspot.
All right, well, we might kick off today's first topic. I'm going to throw over to Joel to give us an overall market update and just a bit of a health check.
Thanks, Steph. Yeah, well, since March, late March of this year, we've certainly seen the US stock market appreciate quite strongly off the back of the lows that the market went through as a result of this COVID-19 crisis. We've also seen many markets around the world respond to the strength that the US stock market has held. However, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've seen a little bit of a sideways price action here and perhaps even more of a correction. Some markets are off around about 3 to 6% at this point in time, at the time of speaking, from their highs around 2 weeks ago. And I guess the question really becomes, well, where to from here? We've certainly seen this big rally and this big bounce off those lows about 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. Should we be expecting a more deeper correction from here? Or should we be perhaps biding our time? Or is this just a short-term pullback with the likelihood that the market is going to continue to rise higher over the next few weeks and few months, and now's a good time to be putting money to work before it starts to move again. So I thought it might be worthwhile just touching base and having a look at our macroeconomic model. There is 5 macroeconomic conditions that we tend to look at to give ourselves a sense of where we are in the economic cycle and what forces are favorable and not favorable for stocks. And we're also looking at the technical picture as well. So all up, we're having a look at 6 different areas, 5 macroeconomic areas, and the 6 being market conditions. And those 6 key areas are really around economic trends, interest rates, valuations, sentiment, financial stress, and stock market technical strength. And when we have a look at the economic trends, what we're really looking for, a flashing sign for us as investors, where we're getting very cautious around economic conditions, would be when typically 4 to 5 of these are flashing red, and at least the other 1 or 2 that aren't flashing red are flashing amber. And the conditions that we're typically looking for are warning signs that would lead us to a period of extreme. Now, extremes can be measured at both the top and at the bottom to give us a sense of whether or not we're getting close to an investable trend to the upside, or whether or not we should be taking money off the table. So if I go through all of this, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to touch on each of these 6 conditions and just give a summary of where we're seeing things at this point in time. Now, when we're looking at economic trends, we're typically looking at gross domestic product, we're looking at unemployment rates, we're looking at the purchasing managers and manufacturing activity indexes. And when we see, when we have a look at these broad macroeconomic overviews, you can see that the economic data right now is horrendous, right? We're seeing retrenchments in the unemployment rate. We're seeing, you know, all-time highs and record highs in unemployment and the growth in unemployment, jobless claims, number of people on Social Security benefits. Looking at the numbers and looking at the data and looking where we are today, it looks horrendous. But what we want to be looking at in this type of at this type of condition is not so much the headline numbers, but what's the rate of change in the rate of change. So what we call the second derivative. So it's more like what is the if the rate of growth is growing in the economy. So let's say the economy is growing at 5% per annum, which is a very fast pace of growth. If it's then continuing to grow at then 6 and 7 and go up in speed, then that acceleration in the rate of growth is a really key indicator for strength in the economy. But then if we're seeing it on the flip side, like what we've seen today, and we're seeing that, you know, economic growth has been contracting really sharply, but then we start to see a decline in the rate of decline. So we see the rate of growth going from, say, a sharp 6%, 7% decline to a 5%, a 4%, a 3%, meaning that it's still declining, but the rate of decline is slowing, then that's what we call the second derivative. And right now we're starting to see some early signs that, yes, during the months of March and April, the retrenchment was at extremes. But just in the last week or so, we're starting to see that the number of jobless claims in the United States have started to slow a little bit. We've started to see that the rate of leading indicators in the economy and the rate of decline in those indicators have started to slow, and that this is perhaps the first green shoots that we've seen, that the worst is definitely behind us in the – well, almost certainly seems to be behind us in the economy. And right now you'd have to say that if we were looking as an investor at what this condition would be guiding us, that this is actually a positive, not a negative, for us to be looking to be investors looking to deploy capital into an economic environment that has a lot of uncertainty. But that on its own is not enough. We need to see what interest rates are doing. And quite clearly, the saying goes, you don't want to fight the Fed, okay? And the Federal Reserve has come out with a big bazooka of support. They're providing a huge amounts of quantitative easing. They've lowered interest rates down to all-time lows again. The interest rate curve is now positive, which means that short-term interest rates are lower than long-term interest rates, and the margin is reasonably healthy for a low interest rate environment. So that overall is also a positive sign. So the first two indicators that we'd be looking at from a macroeconomic perspective would lead us to believe that that these are favorable conditions for investors who are thinking about deploying capital, putting money to work. If we have a look at valuations, just this week we've had Stanley Druckenmiller and David Tepper, two big billionaire fund managers out of the United States, talk about the fact that they believe that the stock market is overvalued and that the risk-reward payoff is the most unfavorable they've seen for quite some time. However, when I break it down, I see very much that valuations around the world are very patchy, and it really is very much dependent upon what type of industry and sector that you're looking at. If you're having a look at resources, financial services, energy companies, there's no way known you can call these sectors as being expensive. Maybe if you're looking at earnings in the very short term because their profits have fallen off a cliff, but if you look at them from their asset backing values, you look at it from their book values and a number of other deep valuation measures, there appears to be significant value in those assets. However, if you're looking at earnings in the very short term, yes, they look expensive because their profits have fallen off a cliff. But if you're thinking about a year or two in advance, you could make an estimation that there's going to be some recovery in those earnings as we come out of this economic trough, then they're not so expensive at the at the valuations that they're trading at. Yes, in technology and healthcare, many of those sectors are looking a little bit frothy in the short term, but much of that overvaluation is specific to large capitalization and mega capitalization companies in those industries of technology, healthcare. Many of the mid-cap and small-cap stocks have really been beaten up and are still trying to find some footing, and they look relatively cheap. And so I would say that valuations on average are mixed, but with the prospects of an improving earnings profile over the next 12 to 18 months, I'd be more inclined to say that valuations are on amber rather than at red, like David Tepper and Stanley Druckenmiller have alluded to.
Hey, Joel, just a quick one. Are there any particular sectors or industries that you would steer clear of? Obviously, airlines is one, but is there anything that really stands out as not investing in at the moment?
Well, look, that really comes down to what style of investing you you employ within your strategy. Here at UGC, we certainly have more of a growth-focused approach. So we like to buy companies that are growing their profits and growing their revenues at a fast pace, and we're prepared to pay up to buy those companies. Now, David Tepper and Stanley Druckenmiller, as traditional value analysts, would say that, you know, that type of approach and many of the stocks that we're buying today are very expensive and probably would shy away from it. Same with your traditional Warren Buffett type investors. But our studies and our research indicates that growth in earnings and growth in revenue is the primary determinant of what drives a share price higher. And if you can find great businesses that are really growing those revenues and those profits in a sustainable manner, then you can afford to pay up for those businesses, and that's where we're finding a lot of the strength right now. And the market has drawn themselves more to those companies, hence why Microsoft and Amazon and Netflix and these types of businesses are trading at all-time highs right now.
Didn't Warren Buffett actually invest in airlines? That wasn't a good one on his side of the fence anyway.
He did, and he actually sold during this most recent decline and sold his investments in airlines, believing that the recovery in the airline and travel sector is going to be much slower than perhaps it would have been in cycles gone past, because he believes that there's going to be a fundamental change and shift in the way that businesses conduct their business these days, and there'll be more cautiousness around people traveling for holidays and perhaps preferring to do more driving holidays in the short term and medium term than flying on overseas holidays. So certainly, if you're one of those value investors, you're going to see that the markets are going to be overvalued with the sectors that are moving higher right now. But we're not so convinced here at UGC, and from the analysis that we're conducting, that valuations are perhaps the best indicator for how to invest in this particular environment. We believe that you want to be pointing your portfolio to high quality, strong balance sheet, fast revenue growing, fast profit growing, and very high visibility growth businesses. And these are the ones that probably are a little bit more expensive than some of the ones that are being completely decimated during this downturn. When we have a look at the fourth segment, the being sentiment, we can clearly see that fear is the overriding factor still, and sentiment still being felt in the investment world right now. The CNN Fear Index is still very much in a fear zone, and in an environment where investors are cautious and pessimistic, stocks climb a wall of worry, and this is actually a very good sentiment reading to be having for investors who are thinking about putting money to work. If we have a look at the financial stress, so I'd give that a tick. So right now, four of the four that we've discussed, three of them I'd give a tick, and one of them I'd give a little bit of an amber reading to. If we have a look at the financial stress index and measures that we look at, financial stress certainly spiked during the panic, but it's come back a hell of a lot, and many of the measures are not too far away from their long-term historical averages right now. So with financial stress easing, with the stimulus that's being provided, the lowering of interest rates, the government handouts, a lot of those financial stress conditions have backed way off. But I think you can't put a green light on that at this point in time because it's still elevated. But I certainly wouldn't be putting a red light on it because it's coming back, not increasing. So, you know, if I'm having a look at those five indicators, I'd say three are absolute greens, two are ambers, and then if we're having a look at market strength and breadth, well, certainly it's been quite a narrow rally since the lows in March, most of the rally has been led by larger companies, but we had started to see some tentative signs that breadth is starting to spread, and that some of the stocks that were laggers and slow to participate are starting to set up and provide and start to join this rally. So we're at this sort of inflection point right now where we need a little bit of a catalyst and need a little bit more information on the economy before I think we're going to see a dramatic move and continuation to the upside. So there's a good chance that we could just bide our time here in a soft sideways correction for maybe the next 6 to 8 weeks while we start to get some further news on opening up of the economies in much of the Western world. And as we start to see that information evolve and the economic conditions start to flow through and hopefully the COVID issues continue to remain under somewhat control, I think that overall this is now a pretty reasonable time to be very selective. You know, not everything's going to be a buy here, right? You need to be very selective with where you're going to put your money. But I think now's a good time to be continuing to pick away and do your research, and don't be afraid to put some money into the market if you haven't already done so.
Good one, Joel. And it's great to hear a little bit of positive news flowing through there. So thank you very much for that update. We're now going to throw to a very quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Welcome back, guys. We're now going to have a bit of a property market update with Brett. What have you got to tell us on the property front, Brett?
Oh, lots, Steph. There's heaps happening. Well, not really happening, but heaps of information flowing around. There was a little bit of source added to the mix by Commonwealth Bank earlier in the week. I don't know if any of you saw the headline that was put out there about the property market dropping 32%.
I did hear something about that, yes.
Yeah, so that was the headline. But if you have a look at what they were actually quoting, they did some modelling based on obviously where they see the stimulus having an impact and how long they see measures being in place for, and their base case is assuming that there'll be a downturn of 11%, but they have some modelling that expects that we're going to be in this downturn for longer and that it's deeper than expected, and only on their worst case scenario does it reach that 32% drop. But of course, the media outlets grab that first headline of CBA forecasting a 32% drop. So they are forecasting an 11% drop, but they have done modelling that says if everything stays bad for a long time and it's worse than we expect, it could get to 32%. So I think anyone could basically say that too.
Yeah, that's just part and parcel of the modelling a bank has to do.
Correct.
I mean, their business model is based on the property market, and they need to be prepared for all scenarios. So they'll be looking at good scenarios and bad scenarios so that they can set their plans.
Yeah.
I guess it is a bit surprising that they've published it all.
Mm. Well, yeah, they regularly publish their data and what they're forecasting. I guess it's which media outlets picked up on it and decided to make headlines of it. So that's why the 32% was what made me want to investigate, because I heard it on the news a few days ago and, yeah, I had a look at what they published. And, yeah, it is only in what they believe would be the worst case scenario that it would get to there.
Well, doom and gloom sells in the news, doesn't it?
Of course it does. And big sort of headlines like that and big numbers do get people, wanting to watch and learn more. So,
yeah,
whether you call it clickbait or news sales, it's probably the main reason they picked up on that. But nonetheless, it is information that they've modelled, and they've got a basis behind why they've modelled it, so it needs to be taken into account. Their 11% rate is interesting. Like it's very similar to what the IMF have been forecasting for Australia's economy and how it's going to perform over the next 18 months. So that's where they're basing that off. Again, there's still no factual evidence to show any of this is actually taking account, but I guess that's why there's a forecast, because it's trying to predict what it will do and prepare for it, which is kind of what we've all got to do as investors and prepare for what we think may come and make the best decision when we're in the ability to do so. Some other news that was not conflicting but probably more supporting of that was that home sales are actually at a 30-year low. So we've spoken about how transactions have dropped significantly in terms of a lot of people just aren't selling. But the amount of transactions is actually the lowest on record now since the early 1990s,
right,
which is a massive drop. The big issue for this isn't just what it does to property values, because, well, if there's no sales, property values don't change a lot. It's the knock-on effect for all of those associated services and the people that support the property industry and make their money out of providing services. So if we think about everyone that's associated with a property transaction, of course, we think of the real estate agent.
Yep.
So there's bound to be a lot
mortgage
of real
brokers.
Estate agents.
Yep.
As you say, mortgage brokers, the conveyancers, the lawyers that do a lot of these transactions and are geared up for doing volume. There's the valuers. And it even flows all the way down to the tradespeople that do the cleanups and the inspections and things. So there's a lot of trades.
That's a very good point.
And even it goes on further to where there's a lot of furniture stores that are seeing a downturn, because when people aren't moving, they're not buying new furniture.
So, a lot of people are on sale at the moment. So, I mean, we're particularly a lot of people that's moved from apartment to apartment. I've certainly noticed an absolute plummet in furniture prices at the moment. They're just basically trying to offload stock.
Yeah.
Have a look online.
Those retailers would be struggling, those big ticket retailers, because they would have forward ordered, you would expect, and they typically forecast a timeline in terms of stock turnovers every month or 2 months, whatever they do. And if they don't happen, they're stuck with stock that they probably hadn't cash flowed their ability to pay.
Yeah.
So they need to be liquidating to be able to pay their bills, we would assume.
Mm.
But it could also come to bite them too. If a lot of their stock is coming from overseas, they may not be able to get new stock if they don't have anything in store.
What happens to, as far as banks are concerned, with the loans? You know, obviously there'll be less loans coming through. Does that change sort of a bank's forecast as well, or what does that mean for them?
Well, the banks would have to be forecasting down on a couple of matters. They're not doing as many transactions, so their loan books would probably be lower than where they would have forecasted them growing. I would also hazard a guess, seeing as though we're seeing mortgage rates below 2%, I would imagine their margins have been squeezed a bit lately too.
Yeah.
I haven't got the data in front of me, but I would imagine their margins have been squeezed a bit. I'm sure they'll still be profitable, but I would imagine for the investors that are holding the major bank shares and are wanting dividends, there's probably not going to be the same amount of profit in the next year or so for them to get the dividends they're expecting.
Yeah. And for people that were looking at buying houses, or, you know, obviously people that have lost their jobs, do you think it's going to have a major impact, or is this just sort of a scare campaign at the moment, you know, given what we're going through?
I think it's still too early to tell.
Yeah.
The other piece of data I've got here that is probably the one that concerns me the most, if we can't rectify it, is immigration.
Right.
If you look at Australia's population and what was supporting, because if we look at the property market, it's not just obviously the buying and selling of existing property, it's the production of new property. And most of the time, the production of new property only comes about when developers and builders have confidence that there's a growing market and there's enough buyers out there to buy new stock. And our population has been growing by over half of our population growth, which is nearly 400,000 a year the last few years, has been through immigration. So if that immigration doesn't start up again soon, you know, that's potentially 200,000 to 250,000 new people a year that won't be looking for homes.
Yeah.
You know, if we average two people a home, that's 100,000-odd buildings that aren't getting built. That's a lot of jobs and a lot of flow-on effects, like we mentioned before, with transactions that aren't going to happen.
What about, though, the more premium sort of developments that will be on the market? What do you think that will happen with that?
that's an interesting one, because there's always going to be a part of the market, and by the market, I guess we talk about people that aren't necessarily at risk with what the economy's doing. They're independently wealthy. They may have a nest egg, or they may have a business or a family wealth that what's happening at the moment for the majority of the world isn't having a significant impact on their financial position. And they'll pick and choose a property based on when they see the right one, or they want the lifestyle change. They're not going to be really dictated to by market conditions. It'll be more them deciding on their own circumstances. I guess the challenge with that is if they're in a financially sound enough position that they're confident enough to be selling a current property and believing they're still going to get the price they want in order to take up something new, and whether they believe there's enough buyers out there. The upper end of the market does move differently to the price pointed end. Sort of the sub-million-dollar homes do tend to move a lot quicker and have more variance in price, more rapidly, because there's less homes at the probably $2 million plus mark and less buyers for them. But those people are a little bit more insulated from financial impact. Well, we would assume there's obviously going to be circumstances around everyone. So a tough one to say, Steph, but you can't necessarily put them all in the same basket. And again, to look at the luxury market, you probably still need to have a look at supply and demand. The data we've seen lately is pretty damning of high density stuff in terms of a lot of the rental vacancies and how a lot of new home builds and new developments are being paused. It doesn't necessarily talk about the quality of the development and the price points. It's more just a blanket statement across that. Because the HIA have also released data this week about how many new home builds are actually starting. So this is a survey that they do every month of the roughly top 30% of the nation's home builders to see how many new contracts they've entered into. And that's saying that they're down 23% on last year.
Okay. It's quite significant.
So it is significant.
I'm actually surprised it's not more.
Yeah, same.
Well, the trend is downward, Louis. 23% were the stats for March and April. Obviously, we're into May now, so we would assume that it's going to continue to drop. The challenge that they presented in the way they get their data is they say that the ABS stats on home approvals tends to not reflect this. Remember last week we spoke about early indicators. This is in effect an early indicator of what the RBA have for dwelling approvals, because the sales happen in advance of the permit application being lodged. So this is almost like a two-month lead time between what the companies are saying they've been able to get contracted, and there's sort of a 2 to 3 month lead time before the builds actually start. So, what we're seeing from the HIA is probably a better indication of the current market versus what the RBA have. And they're saying that if the trend continues down for the next 2 months, it'll almost mean by, August, September, when a lot of these homes will be building, there'll just be a mass exodus of builders and tradespeople, because there won't be enough work around.
Brett, I did hear a little bit of murmurs that, auctions are now back up and running though with these restrictions. I think there's more ability to go out, and I think it's a small crowd that can now gather at auctions. Have you heard that as well?
I have. It's different in each state. I think we're all Victorians, so we're aware that we've probably got one of the stricter states with our Labor government here, who are dictating terms a little bit harsher than some of the other states. So it is on a state by state basis, but they are easing the restrictions to allow more open homes. And with that, more gatherings, which would allow for auctions. I believe there's still limitations on how many people can be within that gathering. So, if I look at the last local auction I went to near my house, even though there might have only been five bidders, there was probably about 40 other people around. And I think they're still trying to keep those gatherings under 10. So it's not ideal, but it could have an effect where we do start to see the flow of more transactions. And obviously auctions, especially around Melbourne, are always the best way to sell, or the most popular way to sell. So I think we might see a spike in activity in the coming weeks purely because of that. A lot of the properties that were prepared for market, more active on the market, and saw that their only way to sell, or their best way to sell, was an auction, might now come back to the market, seeing as though they're sort of three quarters of the way through selling. They may as well go and finish it off, providing they can get their price.
Do you think that this COVID will change the way that auctions are actually held? As you know, would there be? Do you think there'll be more online bidders, or do you think that it will just go back to a normal standard of people wanting to be there on the day and feeling like they're part of that?
Yeah, I think long term, if we assume we get past all this and there's no limitations or restrictions, I think auctions work best when everyone's visible. I think the auctioneer and the sales agents, you know, on behalf of the vendor, do want to be able to read body language and really gauge the audience to maximise price. And I think that's difficult to do in a virtual environment.
Yeah.
I've seen plenty of auctions where there are virtual and physical auctions happening at once. A lot of I think that's probably going to be the main change we might have, is that a lot of real estate agents will start running a combination for people that are interstate or overseas and do want to participate. But I still believe the only way auctions are going to continue to be the thriving, I guess, transaction base they are, it will be with face-to-face and group auctions.
Yeah.
I think that's what generates the best price, and I think that's what people want.
It's a little bit like watching a footy game, isn't it?
Yeah, you want to be in the crowd. Yeah. There's the atmosphere. Yeah. Even though the majority of auctions you attend, less than a quarter of the people there are actually bidding, it's a lot of sticky beaks. It does build momentum and it gives it some atmosphere. And in a lot of ways, most people that are buying at auction are buying to live in. They're not buying for investment purposes. And on that basis, that's where they can get a little bit emotional and go that little bit higher. And I think agents will want to continue to play on that.
I agree.
And you're maybe understating it a bit, Brett, because it's the whole auction process and the way it's designed is really to favour the vendor and maximise that sale price.
Yeah.
It's all built around emotion, and anyone who's been to an auction knows how much emotional emphasis the auctioneer puts on the that final marketing spiel of the property.
The good ones are like showmen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You would appreciate that, Louis, the entertainer in you.
I sure do. Absolutely, yeah. I love it.
I've been to quite a few auctions, and the good ones, sometimes they can be really struggling because the buyers aren't active, but if they are good at not just keeping everyone motivated and entertaining, they do know how to extract whatever the market there can give them.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and a lot of the good agencies, if we look at the averages, and I know I talk Melbourne a lot because we know it the most, typically a Melbourne market will have 1,000 auctions a weekend. So good auctioneers, they're doing up to 5 auctions a day. So it's a big industry, and they typically have 2 or 3 agents supporting them. So it's a big part of the industry, and I think it'll continue on once all of this is resolved.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to throw to another quick break, and we're going to come back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. Now, I've left this topic for the end of the day because this is a big and heavy one, but something we all need to think about at the moment. But it's the end of the financial year, and we're going to talk tax strategies with Louis.
Has that
You've
come around
that
again?
To the end. It's the most exciting.
It is the most exciting. How can I maximise my tax return?
Incredible. This time of the year, eh?
Yeah. Again. So we're recording this on the 15th of May. It gives you 6 weeks to get things in for the end of financial year. Of course, what everyone's looking for is tax-deductible expenses. And there's two things I want to touch on today, and one in a bit of detail and one only needs a brief touch on. The biggest and easiest way to get tax deductions is by making contributions to super. It's now open, and has been for the last few years, now open for anyone to take cash money and make a super contribution and claim a tax deduction on that. You're limited to how much you can put into super, and there's a rule that you're only allowed to put in $25,000 per year in order to claim a tax deduction, and that includes however much your employer has already put in for the compulsory 9.5% payment. So for someone who is on a salary of $100,000 and the employer has already put in $9,500 through the financial year, or is going to have put in that much by the time we get to the end of the financial year, then that person has space within their $25,000 limit. They've still got space of $15,500. So that person could contact their employer and say, can you put in an extra $15,500 into my super? Or that person can take money that's lying around in their bank account and move $15,500 into their super fund and tell their superannuation fund that it is their intent to claim a tax deduction on that money.
What happens if you exceed that amount?
If you exceed that amount, it all gets reported to the ATO by the super funds when they do their reporting. And the ATO will put that data together and they will, if there's multiple super funds, they will add them all up to reach a total. And it works out that you just pay the tax that you would have paid anyway.
Right.
So they do charge you extra tax, but they only charge extra tax that would have been equivalent to what you would have paid through your salary or your taxable income anyway.
Okay.
And we do get clients occasionally complaining where they have put money too much money into super, and they look at it as a penalty. No, it's not a penalty. It's just what you would have paid. Mm-hmm. That extra tax payment, you can even have it paid from your super fund rather than your own pocket. If you don't have the cash money to come up with the tax payment,
okay,
you just get your super fund to pay.
That's something I didn't know.
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, that. Yeah. So look, they're pretty not lenient. They're just flexible and common sense about it these days.
Yeah.
It was about a decade ago that they didn't apply a lot of common sense, and they say no, even though the excess money went into your super fund, you have to pay the extra tax out of your own pocket. And for someone who's got it really wrong, they've suddenly got a tax bill of maybe $5,000 or something like that, and they got to come up with that money out of their own pocket. It's only up to a certain extent, though, so don't go moving $100,000 into super and claiming a tax deduction when you shouldn't. So that is a great way to get a tax deduction. If you use cash money, well, then you're going to put that on your tax return when you do it after the end of the financial year, and you'll get a nice tax refund back when that comes in. If you do it through your employer, well, your employer is going to put the money into super, and they're going to take it from your before tax pay before they send it to you. So if you tell your employer to put in $15,500 to super, your employer is going to do that and only charge you tax or withhold tax on the remaining amount. So if you do it through the employer, you actually get the tax benefits immediately when your salary is paid. Now, this is the first year of a new rule coming into effect that we can actually use. I'm going to talk to people who have a superannuation balance of less than $500,000 for a moment. So firstly, for people with less than $500,000, what are you doing? You should be with UGC and we'll get it over $500,000. That's the first thing I'll say.
Nice plug, Willie.
I had to put it in there. But for people whose account balance is less than that, there's this thing called the carry forward rule. And the carry forward rule came into effect at 1 July 2018. But this is the first financial year we can actually use it. And what the carry forward rule is if you didn't use your $25,000 maximum contribution last year, it carries forward into this year.
That's great.
which is great.
Yeah.
It's one of the great flexibilities that Bill Shorten wanted to abolish, and part of his downfall at the last election, although not as publicly known as some of his other policies.
And does it roll on for more than 1 year, Louis? Like, is there a rolling period that you still have access, or it's only the year after?
Okay. No, it's up to 5 years that can carry forward. So we've got clients who are maybe self-employed and they didn't make any super contribution last year.
Yes.
So they get last year's $25,000 that they could put in, and they get this year's $25,000. So they could put in $50,000 into super this year and get a tax deduction.
Good one.
If you did make some contributions last year, well, then it's whatever the unused part is from last year rolls into this year. And then if you don't do it this year, well, then it's going to roll into next year. So this is where we start getting into some nice tax planning.
Planning, yes.
Yeah. So if someone has variable amounts of income from business, like if your business hit a wall back in February or March, well, then this year's taxable income is going to be low. Maybe next year will be better, and you want to not put your deductions in this year, but you want to put it in next year, you get the benefit of that carry forward. But if you sold an asset sometime this financial year and you've got a huge one this year, well, then maximize your contributions for this year to maximize your tax deductions. So you've got this thing that you can now play with, as long as your superannuation account balance will remain under 500,000.
I think it's a particularly good one for people going through, COVID with their business and, having that downturn. If they can sort of put the funds in years to come, it's a really pretty topical one for the moment.
Yeah, it certainly is. And that ability to juggle it is really helpful. For people who are over the age of 60, if you don't have the cash to make that contribution into super in your pocket right now, there's actually a way that you can draw that money out of super. It's called a transition to retirement pension, and that allows you to withdraw up to 10% of the value of your super fund. And the strategy is, well, if you don't have the, let's call it again, that theoretical $15,500, if you don't have it, well, then you start one of these transition to retirement pensions. You withdraw the money tax-free from super when you're over 60. So you put $15,500 into your bank account, and then you contribute it back into your super fund, and you claim a tax deduction. And it almost sounds illegal. You move money from one place to another place, and then you move it back again. And you get a tax deduction.
That's tax. Yeah, sounds like tax avoidance.
It's awesome. and it's totally legal. It's all within the rules. It's just this thing that we can do in order to optimize someone's tax position. We only do it when people don't have the cash money or other resources that they can draw on in order to do it. But we certainly do it for a good number of people.
Nice.
For people with an account balance of more than $500,000, you can still maximize this year's $25,000 contribution. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, what are you doing with your account balance in super? You should be contacting UGC to manage your superannuation balance.
Spot on.
Well done.
I didn't have both, didn't I?
Well said.
All right. So, look, the last end of financial year strategy I'll plug today is for people with investments, look at what investment expenses you can bank into this financial year. The one that often comes up is prepaying interest on an investment loan. So contact your lender and see if you can pay 12 months interest in advance. The other one I'll put a plug on is people with investment properties. There's a lot of tradies who are twiddling their thumbs right now. And now would be a great time, firstly for yourself, because you can get an available tradie, maybe at a good price. And secondly, it's good for the economy as well. If you can get someone into your home, if you're in a position to do so, that would be really nice. And even if you're not, if you don't have the cash to do it out of your own pocket, you could even increase your investment loan for the investment expense so that you're able to spend the money now and get the tax deduction on it and fund it through an increased investment loan, which is then tax deductible when you pay the future interest on it further. Mm. So there you go. Well, there's tax strategies for you.
Yeah. Yep. Hey, Louis, just another quick one, which is a much smaller tax break if you were going to get it. But given that there's so many people working from home, I did hear that you can actually log hours and claim hours working from home at the moment. Is that something that you've heard of as well?
Yes, it is. It tells me that when you don't participate in the podcast, you don't listen to it either.
listen, I've got them all ready to go.
Smackdown for Stan. Gotcha. You
just
walked
just
right
fill me back in, Louis, in case other people hadn't heard it just like myself.
But yeah, I'll fill you in. So the ATO did come out and say the usual complicated rules for making deductions for working from home. We've created a new set of simple rules, which is exactly that. You keep a record of the number of hours from home that you've worked, and the ATO will let you deduct it at a certain rate. I don't have the rate of how many cents per hour of work or dollars per hour of work, but a tax accountant will be able to help you through. It only applies from, I think it was the 1st of March that it applied from, but it's a much more simple method, and it will only be temporary. It won't continue past the coronavirus situation, but it's a much easier way. And the reason is there's a lot of people who are working on their dining room tables at the moment, and under the old rules, the only way you could get deductible expenses is if you have a permanently set up home office.
Okay.
And you measure the number of square meters that you use in that permanently set up square home office. So if it's a room that's 3 meters by 4 meters, that's 12 meters of floor space compared with the total floor space of your apartment or your home, which might be 12 meters out of 80 meters total or 12 meters out of 120 meters total. And that's the percentage of your home expenses that you can then deduct.
How does someone prove that you've got a home office, though? Do they come in with a measuring tape from the tax office and assume you've got one?
Great question, Steph. I do not know how they would audit that.
Look, essentially, I mean, we work in a self-reporting tax system. So they're going to look for consistency around the deductions each year in regards to these types of deductions. And if all of a sudden you're starting to see, you know, get bigger and bigger and bigger, they're going to start questioning whether or not these are legitimate deductions.
Yeah, right. Good advice. And sorry, loyal listeners, for going through that COVID information about how you log your hours from home, but good to get a rehash on it anyway.
always.
All right. Well, look, we might wrap it up there. We're going to throw to our last segment for the day, which is You Can't Be Serious. Now, I've been watching Joel's face because he has been doing some research, and I can see him chuckling away
at some of
the ones that he's found. So we might start off with you, Joel, considering that you've been having quite a lot of fun there.
Thanks, Steph. Look, I just every now and then I'm curious to see what business fails tend to pop up. And, you know, these are businesses that have advertised or come up with some form of advertising campaign or billboard or whatever it might be, and the message just doesn't quite hit the mark. So I've been looking through a few of these, and the first one that I come up with is a billboard that points to a resort, but the resort is Big Dicks Halfway In. I thought that was the first one. That was a funny one that I came across. And there's another shop that says open 8 days a week, close Sunday. And then there's another billboard that I came across where it says this is for a dream therapy company. Consider dream therapy today. And on it has a gentleman that is looking at you in a very very much in a analyzing sort of frame with his face, and it says, "While you sleep, we analyzed your dreams."
Oh. Oh, wow, that's charming.
And so, you can't have a funny billboard without something referring to a Chinese restaurant. So we've got Fu, F-U, King Chinese Restaurant.
Yeah.
And then we've got this last one. I'll finish on this last one here. This is a billboard from the Rotary Club somewhere down in obviously in the United States. And it's a big billboard from Rotary giving out a nice public message that says, "Don't read. This billboard whiles driving. Distraction kills." And it's probably the most distracting billboard you can come up with.
That's right.
They got their message across, didn't they?
One of my favourite restaurants in Melbourne is called Lee Ho Fook.
I know.
I'm always calling Ho Lee Fook.
Yeah. I love the language.
What about you guys? Any fruit for you?
Well, it's pretty hard to pick y'all.
Well, I might have one. IKEA put something out to the public around the world as just a reminder not to masturbate in their stores.
Oh,
goodness.
And apparently there was a video of a woman in China masturbating on various pieces of furniture around the store.
Wow. She must have been very stimulated by all that furniture she saw.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe it was the Swedish meatballs. all right, I'll touch on one just purely because a few weeks ago we mentioned how we were expecting divorce rates to go up when everyone was in isolation, spending too much time together. One particular man has gone a little bit further, and he's actually lodged a file in court to allow him to have a sword fight with his wife to render their souls.
Oh, really?
Yep. The background behind it is that they've got an ongoing dispute about custody and visitation and property tax payments. But he was then ordered to have a psychiatric treatment, and the judge did come back and say he is not insane, he's not troubled, he's just has adjustment disorder with mixed emotional features. It's sort of you're innocent but guilty.
Yeah. I love it.
And guys, I've got a special public announcement for if coronavirus and all of this being locked away has turned you into an alcoholic. I'd like to offer some help. Liquor home
you're
delivery.
You're offering help,
256-335. Call us on 256-33287 for liquor home delivery.
Can I just add to that? Joel's job is to put out our recycle bin. When he tips it up out there, he said to me last night, "Could you hear it in the apartment?" And yes, I could.
Good for the economy,
it's
guys.
It's all the past the sauce local bottles, yeah?
Oh, sure it is. Yeah. That's no better either. All right, guys. Well, look, we'll wrap it up there today, but have a fabulous weekend. Enjoy those dinner parties that you may be having with your five friends. And, have a fabulous time and enjoy socialising.
Thank you. Yes,
will do. Thanks, Steph.
All right. See you next week.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.